Hi, everybody. My name is Rana, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 27th, 1997. Thank you. And I am from the Federal Way Women's AA group in Federal Way, Washington, and I live in Tacoma, Washington. And I want to say I am really honored to come and open up the conference and speak and then, like, to get this over with so I can enjoy the rest of Yeah, because there's that internal struggle, and I know that some people say, oh, you know, you're just trying to. There's nobody to impress here, you know, and I do understand that, but there is an internal struggle that goes on. I think of wanting to show up and to do your best, and when you come from a place for a long time that you weren't your best, that to come up here and to want to give you that best means something. And so I think that for me, that's what my internal struggle becomes as I stand here. I'm a Cree woman, and I'm African-American. My family comes from Canada, First Nation Cree, from a little reserve right outside of Regina called Paiepot. My grandmother was one of the first Buffalo women who came into the States. Her name was Mary Buffalo. And she married a Chappican, and as a result of his alcoholism beatings, she ended up coming to the States. Well, she was blind all of my life, but not all of her life. And following her was my mother and my aunties and my uncle. And my grandmother actually, when she became blind, she actually came to Seattle to learn how to do Braille. And then ended up in Montana, where she was one of the first Crees that were part of the Chippewa Cree tribe of Rocky Boy, Montana. And I was born on the High Line in a little town called Haver. And along with my mother coming into the States, my aunties, had alcoholism. And I remember these beautiful full-blood Cree women in my life, and I remember how they loved me. I remember that there was this unconditional love, but I also saw alcoholism that I didn't know that's what it was. And when I would see them, and there were certain times, like, when they were fighting amongst one another, right? And for a child to see that there is, you just kind of try to make your way through the insanity of that, of it all. And remember, for me, it was kind of like just kind of shutting down. It was just easier just to kind of go away. And then eventually they were gone, and I didn't know why they were gone. And later on in my life, I learned that they died from alcoholism. And, before I go any further with my story, I am really grateful to be standing here, and I'm very honored to come and speak. And I thank you, Zan, for thinking of me to come and just hold Cindy, who was going to be here in light. She was ill to be here, and I got to come in her stead. And that when I did get the news, I was very happy. Because one of the things that had happened before I got that call is that I was at a place where, when I pray, I like to sit on the side of my bed, or I like to be sitting Indian style on my bed, legs crossed over, and I like to pray like that and make conscious contact. But where I've been in my life, I've been kind of broken. And in this space, I thought, I'm going to get on my hands and knees because I really need to. And so I did that, and when that phone call came, there was a message that I was to come. To me, it was that answer. It was the answer to my prayer. And I wanted to read this part where the theme of this weekend is from Bridge to Shore in the big book on page 56. And I'm just going to read it because it is kind of starting off this weekend. And so I'm going to read it for everybody on page 56 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our friend was a minister's son, and he attended church school, where he became rebellious at what he thought an overdose of religious education. For years thereafter, he was dogged by trouble and frustration, business failure, insanity, fatal illness, suicide. These calamities in his immediate family embittered and depressed him. Post-war disillusionment, ever more serious alcoholism, impending mental and physical collapse brought him to the point of self-destruction. One night when confined in a hospital, he was approached by an alcoholic who had known a spiritual experience. Our friend Gorge rose as he bitterly cried out, "If there is a God, he certainly hasn't done anything for me." But later, alone in his room, he asked himself this question, "Is it possible that all religious people I have known are wrong?" While pondering the answer, he felt as though he lived in hell. Then, like a thunderbolt, a great thought came. It crowded out all else. "Who are you to say there is no God?" The man recounts that he tumbled out of bed to his knees. In a few seconds, he was overwhelmed by the conviction of the presence of God. It poured over and through him with the certainty and majesty of a great tide at flood. The barriers he had built through the years were swept away. He stood in the presence of infinite power and love. He had stepped from bridge to shore. For the first time, he lived in conscious companionship with his Creator. And that, for me, was really powerful to read, because that's why coming here meant so much, because he fell to his knees, and then there was the answer. And that's exactly what happened as a result of me coming. So when I did pick up the phone, and I don't know, I don't think I sounded as exaggerated as Harlan made me seem to sound last night. I was like, you know, I was just so happy, because it was truly that answer coming to me. And that's how God shows up, you know, when I'm in that true humility. And I am truly grateful to be here speaking. You know, when I was thinking about that place, from bridge to shore, you know, it truly is, you know, when coming in here, the calamities of the past, you know, dealing with alcoholism first, so I was born into it, and then to watch it, and then to take it on my own and run with that baton, and then to pass it on to my own children, right? It was like a very, you know, coming here, it just kind of seemed very grim. But, you know, the part for me, and, you know, the big book where it talks about that, you know, it's not so much what happened to us, it's the way we reacted to our, you know, our childhood experiences, that I had a lot of practice from the very beginning. And, you know, in alcoholism, my mom was somebody who would, she would run away from home. She would go and she would get her, you know, get her drink, and she would, my dad would go find her. He would beat the holy living lights right out of her, and almost a couple of times to the point of death. And, you know, as a child, I remember seeing that, and I know that I have been told that I have the PS, the post-traumatic stress disorder, because of the things that I had seen. And so coming in here and sharing those things, it's very delicate for me, because I feel very protective of my family, but this is the best place to share it, because I know that each and every one of you know and understand what alcoholism does to a family. And in this space, you know, my mom, in her alcoholism, the beatings were passed down to her, and for some reason, I don't know what this was about, but I know that a lot of the physical violence was passed on to me. And in that space, I was stabbed a couple of times by her with a fork or with a can opener. Just in her rage and anger. And as a child, you just kind of, you know, what do you do with that? Well, for me, I make things up. You know, I have no place to go with it. I'm not going to go tell. Because in this home of mine, that these are the things, that this is kind of how it is. And I was always very slow in school because of the fact that I, you know, it was really hard to go and study and do math and to learn when you had that kind of violence going on. And so I was always in tutors and, you know, being helped and in all the special classes. And, you know, it was really tough to learn. And, you know, coming out of that home, we were constantly in and out of foster care. I really loved my foster. I mean, if you're a foster parent, I love you. I still keep in contact with my foster mom, Betty Smith, and, you know, it was kind of like coming out of the insanity of our home and into this place where, you know, she put pajamas on us and, you know, we had like three meals a day and, you know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, it was just a really very safe place to go. And I didn't like going back home. when, you know, I didn't like going back home to my home because it was so unstable. Except for I did have brothers and sisters who were going through the same thing. A lot of times we were split up because there were so many of us. Sometimes I was lucky enough that I got to go stay with my grandma, who was blind, and it was fortunate for me. You know, even the wonderful gifts as along the way, that at the age of 4, I was her eyes, and I used to walk her, you know, down the street, you know, and I'd have to tell her when to step and, you know, and when to step up. And sometimes I'd go in a daydream world and she'd stumble, you know, and she'd smack me with her cane. Not hard, just enough to get my attention. But, you know, that was really a blessing to be able to be her eyes. And I didn't know, like, that the life that I would carry on later on, that a lot of the things that I would do in my careers would be that kind of work. But my grandmother's home was always, you know, it seemed like there was people constantly coming in and out. I always felt different, and I thought it was because I was Indian. You know, I thought, you know, and I know that we probably have to break it down to something, you know, because alcoholism, the ism factor of alcoholism was not the thing that entered my mind at the time. All I knew is I felt different. And the only thing I could see around me, because we lived in the community of Haver, our reservation was 15 miles out, was that, well, usually when things went wrong, it was because the Indians did it, you know. And so I thought that that was because the reason why I was different was because I was Indian. And then when my cousins would come from Rocky Boy, I remember one of my cousins saying, boy, those half-breeds are taking over the reservation, you know. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, I can't tell her that I'm half black, you know. I was like all the time trying to cut off parts of me to try to fit in, you know, and I couldn't fit in here because, you know, it was because I felt like I was Indian. I couldn't fit in on my reservation because I was half-breed. And so I'd always try to, you know, always try to cut something off just to be accepted, to fit into my tribe, my people, my family, my community. And so when I came, by the time I got here, I was pretty chopped up, you know, and I didn't know what the heck I was. You know, when I ended up picking up the bottle myself and hanging out with friends, and in the beginning it was pretty fun. I had a good time. It was kind of nice to kind of, you know, lose myself. It was kind of fun to be funny and feel good and to, you know, like that extemporaneous effect, you know, of just kind of doing things you wouldn't normally do. And then, you know, later on down the road, you know, I stopped drinking. I ended up pregnant with my oldest girl, Donna, who got to share read today. You know, I started drinking, and I got pregnant, and so I stopped drinking, fortunately, with her. And I ended up being a part of a church. And, you know, again, you know, I didn't know that I had alcoholism. I didn't know that in this church, you know, when they asked me to do certain things, I couldn't understand why I couldn't do it. They asked me to be sin-free. And, you know, that, I mean... I remember thinking, you know, I had no defense. I grew up in violence, and so I remember one time my husband had done something. He really made me upset, and I remember slapping him in the face with a shoe. And then the church, they withdrew from me because they told me I shouldn't do that. And so they withdraw from you. And I remember, you know, trying to figure out in that book, you know, like, I don't understand, you know, what, I don't understand why I'm not supposed to do that. And they couldn't show me, you know, that they said something about it was better for a man to be on a rooftop than to be with some kind of a crazy wife, you know. And and I remember, you know, I remember thinking, you know, just feeling the shame and the guilt around that because I didn't know how to handle it any other way. You know, and I was constantly withdrawn from. I mean, it was kind of like I'd be really good. They let me back in, and then I would get withdrawn from again because you're not supposed to smoke weed. You know, and so I couldn't figure that out. And I remember just, you know, I can't do this. I can't. I don't know how to be this. You know, I was trying to play the homemaker. By the time I was in that church, I ended up having my second child, Daniel, and. And, you know, it was kind of, you know, really wonderful. There had these moments where, you know, I'd be cleaning the house up and my husband would be at work and, you know, I'd have the dinner cooked for him. And, you know, I had those little brief moments of, like, that's like a perfection it looked like. And, but it only lasted only about as long as a half hour episode of Leave It to Beaver, you know. Of being in that space where it just everything was right, you know, perfect. But in the back of my head, I have the stirring. You know, all of a sudden there's this tightening up, and you know, there's certain things I can't handle. You know, I want to partake in this thing called communion, but you can't if you don't have you can't if you have sin on you. And so I was kind of I did it once, and even then I wasn't quite sure if I was, because I have a disease of perfectionism too, and so I'm very critical of my nature. And so I never partook but only once, and even then I felt guilty because I'm sure I had something somewhere if I looked hard enough. And you know, finally I just ended up leaving because it was just tiring. I was exhausted. Every time people saw me, they would turn the other way because I was always coming asking for forgiveness of something, you know. And then I would ask forgiveness for asking for forgiveness for the thing I asked for forgiveness for before. It was that kind of thing. You know, I just ended up leaving, and as a result of that, I ended up turning back to alcohol. You know, I didn't know that I had an alcoholic ego, that when those kind of things started getting tough, that's where I would go. That was my answer. And as a result of that, I lost my children in a court custody battle to their father. And at the time, I could tell you, like right now I sit here, I can tell you that that was the best thing that could have happened for them. But for me, I used it as a victim, as a state of victimization, that it was every reason that I had to be able to go out and say, you know, they did this to me. I can't believe he lied in the court, you know, that kind of stuff. But you know what? And this is the only time this is the only place I ever share this, is in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. But after I left that court hearing, I felt so guilty and ashamed. But what was the deepest, dark part of my secret was that when I was walking down the street, that there was a part of me that said, well, now I can get on with my drinking business. Because I wanted to party. I wanted to go out and live. And I remember telling my husband, you know, if you think I'm the type of woman who's going to be sitting around while you're out doing your thing, and I'm going to be here taking care of kids, you have another thing coming. And you know what? I ate those words for many, many years. And I suffered at the result of the guilt and shame of not having my two oldest children with me. I kept on going. I started drinking hard liquor, which I never, I remember the first time I tried gin, I was like, oh my God, that stuff is nasty. It tastes like pine cones. And then, you know, next thing you know, it's like, that's my drink of, you know, that's my favorite drink by the time, you know, the end of the story. And it just takes time. You just kind of get used to it and it kicks in. And you know, I ended up started getting blackouts, I have women who I sponsor today that who come in, who are dealing with CPS, and who said, you know, I need to get my kids back. This has happened to me, and I need to get back. And I think that, you know, that's their bottom. And for me, that was my bottom at the age of 23. You know, and then I had another bottom after that, and after that, I had so many bottoms. But some people's bottoms can be that, you know, just they get their kids away. You know, help me get my kids back. And for me, I just, you know, I just kept on going. And I tried to get sober. I ended up married again, but I didn't divorce the first guy, my first husband. Who has time for divorce and dealing with the court system when you got business going on? I was married to both of these men, and fortunately neither one of them pressed charges against me, because that's why I heard you can get in trouble for that. And eventually my first husband ended up doing the divorce filings and stuff like that. And you know, talks about that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, you know, waking up next to somebody you don't know. I would sometimes towards the end, I would sit there and go, you know, I just had my eyes closed, and I knew I was, you know, I knew the drunk before, the night before, and I was sitting there, please be home, please be home, please be home. And sometimes I was, and sometimes I wasn't, you know. And that's such a scary feeling. And I come into the rooms, as my disease progressed, you know, I ended up having one more baby in 1994, and fortunately, you know, I don't, you know, by the grace of God, I have to say that, you know, I know that I did drink with her, but, you know, not like I know that I wanted to, and you know, she came through okay, but she was through the 3 years of my drinking was pretty bad, because at the result, you know, I said, I'm never going to try. I'm not going to do things like crack cocaine, because you know, that's not something that I want to do, because I know I'll like it. And I knew that. I had no doubt. But one drunk night, I was hanging out with a friend, and sure enough, you know, she says, I'm going to go cop. And I didn't know what that meant, but I do now. And I gave into that. And that was where my fall was. That's where, crawling on the floor, and you're pretty sure you dropped something, but if you're a real crack addict, you don't drop anything. You just think you do. And you smoke breadcrumbs and pieces of rice and stuff like that, because you're pretty sure you did drop it, but you just don't know where. And I'm crawling on the floor. I remember saying, get up, girl. You know you did not drop anything on the floor. And I'd get up, and then I'd be right back down there again. The obsession was so. I was just taken. And the last time that I used, I was driving. Me and my girlfriend went and copped, and I've been dealing with this particular dealer for quite a while, and I'm gonna let you know, at the same time I'm going to school to become a court reporter. Yeah. And so I went to this dealer and I wrote a check on account that didn't exist. And I remember the fear that I felt as a result of that. I had actually heard about treatment, and it was actually from her, because I remember she came out and, we were sitting around drinking and getting high, she had this big thing of something, right, of a rock. And I remember saying, how do you not do that? How do you just, not to take that and just go and hide in the closet and not smoke the whole thing? And she said, well, I went to treatment. And that was truly the first time I heard about treatment. I didn't know what it was, but, I was like, God, that's really powerful. Yeah. I remember sitting there, after I did that, I was really afraid for my family because, even though I was dealing with these people for a while, they were still very, unstable people. And messing with their money was not a cool thing. And I remember the fear that I had, after the high comes down. I was just like, oh, my God. It's like, I was trying to take a hit off that pipe. And then I remember trying to put it down. I remember saying, I can't stand this stuff. And I couldn't put it away. And I knew that it had me. I sat there with a tumbler of rum, which I didn't like rum. I remember I was at my Lucky Ladies meeting, and I remember saying, it doesn't matter, you're an alcoholic. I remember somebody saying that to me. But I was sitting there just trying to go into oblivion. I didn't want to think about what I just did. I might have had my family in, for some reason this time, I probably had my family in danger many, many times driving drunk with my child or my children. But this particular thing was pretty scary to me and hit me pretty hard. And I remember looking at my friend, and I said, I don't want to do this anymore. And she said, we'll do something about tomorrow. And I remember the feeling. And I used to think it was surrender, but I think it was just like the alcohol beat me down. I was like, no, I really don't want to do this anymore. And I woke up the next morning, and I remember I looked at my husband. Because my husband, he had his own denial thing going on anyway. But I was a real good liar, cheat, and thief. If money came missing out of the account, it was like, oh, my purse, I lost my purse. I don't know what happened to it. But look, I found my driver's license and my other stuff, but my purse, it's gone, And I'm sure, like I said, his denial and his own stuff that he had going on was, kept him in that space he couldn't see. And he said, well, why don't you go to treatment? And I was like, well, I was so agitated because it sounded so simple. But I knew I was in trouble. And it was a Sunday, actually. April 27th was a Sunday. So I had to wait till Monday because I didn't think of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't my thought because I thought my mom goes to Alcoholics Anonymous. But, my mom, she had a liver the size of a football and was on her deathbed. And the priest would come in and they were doing her last rites, I believe that's what they call it. And so I'm not like that. So I don't need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm still going to school. I have a 4.0 GPA, and so I'm doing okay. I think, let's go to treatment. And I made up in my mind, because I make things up, and I said, treatment, it's like going to be like they're going to teach me something. I don't know what they're going to teach me, and I'm going to go get better. So on that Monday, I woke up that morning, I picked up the phone, and I called Group Health. And I was talking to this gentleman on the other end of the phone, and I told him, you know, what was going on. And he's like, well, we don't have any openings, but we will in 2 weeks. And he said, and you know what, this is long before I even knew that passage that says that we forget about the pain and suffering that we go that we went through just 2 weeks or, you know, 2 months ago, that we forget. And I said, you know, I don't think that I'll make it because I think I'll forget. And I don't know that I have another chance because, see, I had almost, I broke the rhythm of my heart. Gosh, way, I don't even know what year it was, because I drank so much that I got alcohol poisoning, and I have chronic arrhythmia, and when I'm really stressed out is when you can really, when I really know that, when that arrhythmia really kicks in. But I remember after coming off of a binge, you know, where with my husband, we were hanging out with some of his friends in Sacramento at the Air Force Base, and they had this funnel of liquor. They, you know, you don't even taste it. It just goes right straight down, right to your belly, and poof, right there, right? It's like, yeah, just perfect. And and they, you know, and I mean, I did that for the whole weekend. And my skin burned to the touch, and, you know, my heart, the rhythm of my heart was broken, and I just thought I was dying. But even then, I still had a few years to go. And then I, you know, different times when I was getting high and drinking and smoking crack, that, you know, I could feel my heart getting ready to explode, you know, and it didn't. And my best thinking was to pull the pipe back up. And so I knew, you know, I told him, I was like, I don't know that I have that in me, 2 weeks. And yeah, he must have heard me. He must have heard something, because he got me in that night. And I ended up, they sent me to you, which I wasn't too pleased about, but, you know, it was just at that place where I was willing. You know, I was just kind of at that place where he says you're willing to, you know, push a penny across the floor with your nose. And not that they would put you through that kind of humiliation, but just the willingness of that. That you know, I've done everything I could. I've tried to quit drinking on my own. I remember I was, like, back in 1988, and I come off of a binge, and I, you know, I was like, okay, I promise I won't drink, you know. My husband got mad at me for some reason. Okay, I'm going to quit. And, you know, and I remember the feeling of, it felt like somebody had ripped the flesh off of me, because I had no resistance. I had nothing, no defense against what no meant. I thought no meant that, you know, I wasn't enough. I thought that wrong meant I was stupid. You know, I had, you know, the shame and the guilt of my kids being there and I'm here. What do you do with that? And when that stuff starts tightening up, because I don't have anything else to weigh in the balance of that, and it starts tightening up, that at 2 months, right, I lasted. And that was like white-knuckling it. And as in the balance of that, it was kind of like, I was like, you know, girl, you need to go have yourself a drink. You know, and I did. It was the 4th of July. It was a good time to come out, you know, come back. And I went and bought myself a really pretty dress, you know, really beautiful. And I felt really nice. I was going to go to a barbecue and play cards with some friends and have a good time and, you know, have a few drinks and, you know, do it different. And, you know, and the next morning, you know, I wake up and my best friend's like, you don't even want to know, you know. And I just remember, oh, my head, my brain was swollen in my skull. My pretty dress, like, I don't know what happened to half of it. I was like, you know, I don't remember. I was wearing somebody's big old sweatshirt, and I just was a mess. And I remember thinking, oh, that's why I quit. And I, you know, and there was just no defense against it. Well, this time when I went into treatment, they gave me some stuff, you know. They told me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and so I did. And I remember, you know, I remember it was Alki Tuesday Nighters and My Lucky Ladies. And that's kind of like who raised me in my beginning years of recovery. And as I walked through that, it was really tough, you know. I mean, into the third month of, you know, I remember being able to, I remember my husband had said something that really aggravated me, you know, and I remember I just started pounding on him. I went crazy. And he was like, you know, and I thought it was because you're an alcoholic, but you're just a crazy bitch. And I remember I collapsed on the floor. And I remember thinking, what's the point of being sober if I'm still going to do this, you know? I remember the thoughts running through my head, you know, of, you know, how do you live with these thoughts, you know? And, you know, fortunately, on that bridge to shore, that there was a woman just a week before I had attacked my husband who came into, she was actually Lucky Ladies meeting, who talked about that she had done that to her husband, you know? And I remember thinking to myself, you know, when that, after that happened, that I didn't have to go back out. And that's what she said. She said, that happened to me, but I didn't have to go back out, you know? And then the women in recovery taught me that, you know, you can be angry, but you do not have the right to hit, you know? And it was just kind of like you were teaching a kid, because it was like, really? Okay, I won't hit, you know? And I, you know, I practiced not hitting. And, you know, and, you know, in that journey, oh, yeah, you know, when I always, and I always forget to say this, but I'm so glad I didn't, but my eighth month of recovery, I tell you, it was Christmas, and I remember somebody at the podium saying, you know, if you, in order to get rid of depression, you have to let go of elation, right? And I remember thinking, that just sounds rude. It sounds like, you know, elation, that sounds like a really happy place to be, you know, but I get that today, because I it was Christmas time, and I remember getting into, you know, I was like, da-da-da, you know, all that stuff, and, you know, getting ready for Christmas, and, you know, getting all caught up in the hype of that, and then it was over, and it was like this crash, boom, you know, oh my God, is this it? And I got a phone call on the 26th of December from my daughter, Donna. And she said, Dad said I can come live with you. And I just didn't fall for it. I was like, put him on the phone. And so he said, yeah, he's like, we just can't deal with her anymore. Come and get her. And that was, you know, I'm going to tell you, December of 1997, that there was a big blizzard that was through the pass. And all the flights were booked up because it was right after Christmas. And I tell you one thing, you know, it might have seemed really crazy, but it was me, my sister's little brand new red Saturn, and the snow plows going through Snoqualmie Pass to go get that girl. So I was bringing her home, and she hasn't been gone since, and I'm so grateful for that. I got to bring my girl home, and we got to start our journey together. And it's just like, you know, down the road, you know, in my recovery, is the women were teaching me how to be a mom, you know, that, you know, about a year and a half later, I was driving on my way to school, and I just remember saying, you know, God, I don't know how I'm going to be the best mom to my son, Daniel, while he's there, and he comes once a month on a weekend, but just when he's here, help me to be the best mom that I can. You know, and that kind of surrender, when you're in it, I don't even know that I'm in it kind of thing, that, you know, I get a phone call that night, and it says Daniel called, and he says he wants to come home, he wants to come live with us, and I brought my son home, and I tell you, that's the best feeling to have, is when all your children are underneath the same roof, because the opposite of that is like when you come out of a drunk, you know, and then that kind of like there's a reality that kind of kicks in, it says, what are you doing here, and your babies are over there. And the only thing you can think to do is just to cover it all back up and to take the next drink just to get rid of the pain. But it was truly a wonderful feeling that moment. I'm laying there and they're all there. All three of my children are there. Life is good. As I'm walking through my journey, you know, I'm just trying not to pick up, and especially in that first year. That first year, I remember saying, well, God, you know, I'm going to go over to my friend's house, and if she has crack, I think I'm going to smoke it. You know? You know, fortunately, you know, I mean, really, but for the grace of God, there was those moments there. But in the time I'm being, there's something happening, you know, these people are teaching me, teaching me how to show up. I'm going to meetings, I'm not drinking in between, I remember this time I was sitting there, my sister was getting ready to go back to Columbus, Ohio, and I don't do well with abandonment, because even though she had her reasons, for me, it was she was leaving me. I remember I sat there with this glass of white Zinfandel right in front of me, and I remember thinking, I really don't want to drink it, but I do want to drink it because I don't want to feel these feelings. I just don't want to feel that she's leaving me. I had been to a meeting. I had been to a meeting where this wonderful lady, you know, I was sharing about some stuff I was going through, and she came up to me and she gave me this card. And she was an elder, and it was in Ballard, a meeting in Ballard. And she gave me this card, and on the card it said, the biggest failure we make in life is giving up what we want the most for what we want right now. Change the thought before it becomes an action. And when I sat there and I read that card, I remember thinking, you know, I'd memorized it. And the only reason why I memorized it, because it sounded so good that I wanted to share in a meeting so that you guys would see how good it sounded, you know. But I didn't realize how important that card was going to mean to me that time when that glass of wine was sitting in front of me, because that was the words that were going through my head over and over and over again. Because what I wanted to most was I wanted to stop hating the woman in the mirror. I wanted to stop cursing her. I wanted to know what it felt like, you know, to be whole. I wanted to know what it felt like to be able just to, you know, I didn't even know what I even wanted, but I know I didn't want what I had, right? And I sat there and I remember pushing that drink away, and I didn't even have a reaction to what I had just been through until the next day of what I had almost given up, because I had never stopped drinking for the reasons that I had this time. Before, it was because I got thrown in jail, or because I ended up sleeping with somebody I didn't know, or my husband found out, or, you know, whatever those things that alcohol, that demoralizing place that alcohol takes us, those are the reasons why. It was never for the reason of, I'm just tired. I'm tired of being here. I don't want to do this anymore. And I didn't pick up that drink. I'm so grateful for that moment. And I've had a couple of moments like that, you know, coming through, and, you know, of just like the insanity. And if you're early in recovery, this is probably really fresh for you right now. And of just that, you know, I just remember being at an AA meeting, because I was sitting there. I saw this little piece of white something, and I thought, oh my God. That is crack cocaine on that floor at this AA meeting. You know, like everything is right, this really hypersensitive. Like, God, what if somebody steps on it? What are you going to do? Well, maybe you should pick it up. Well, what am I going to do? I don't have nothing to smoke it in. What am I going to do? You know, that kind of thing. And fortunately, somebody must have stepped. I know it must have been something besides that. I mean, not an AA meeting. But, you know, that's kind of like where your mind goes. And, if I'm driving in the car, all of a sudden I become the drunk police. You know, somebody swerves, like, pull up. I'm pretty sure they're probably smoking crack while they're in the car. You know, for some reason I wanted to kind of get up in there and check and see if that's what they were doing. Because most people, you know, it has nothing to do with them trying to put a CD in the player or something like that. Or maybe they just, you know, the phone rang or something. But it was just kind of like that kind of thing. And I remember as I was doing my first job I had as a court reporter, I was doing a testimony for, doing dispatching tapes. And I could hear I was like, oh, I didn't know anything about it at all. All I'm supposed to do is just take and translate these tapes into hard copy. And I'm sitting there and I'm listening and I'm thinking, I wonder what's going on here. And I heard, you know, they're talking about something about Costco. And, you know, I heard some kind of, you know, things going back and forth. And then the lady goes, ooh, I dropped my needle. I was like, oh, my God, they're doing, she's a heroin addict. And she is taking, and she dropped her needle because she needs to get more drugs. And they're going to go to Costco for some reason. I don't understand why they're going to go to Costco. But I'm thinking, I'm going to help them break this case, right? And I'm sitting there, and I have my earphones on, and I'm to the point where I get this earache, you know, because I'm trying to break everything down to make sense of it. And then, like, further about, almost like when I'm done with the tapes, she had dropped her knitting needle. But when you're in that kind of state of mind, that's what it's all about, you know. It's just like it takes a while to come out of that, and I, you know, just that kind of thinking, it just takes a while. Well, and in my first year, was I think that by the grace of God, I've never had any terrible tragedies happen. Aside from, you know, like death, I mean. And my grandma, she passed away in 91 she was old. She was ready to go. And so my grandma had a good life and she had a good death. And we were ready for that. But in 1998, my oldest sister, Patricia, I got a phone call that said she had overdosed from heroin. And when we had talked, the detectives had come and talked to us about that and had said that she, when we asked about the bruises that she had, and he says, oh, you know, with her kind of lifestyle, she probably got beat up by a boyfriend. And I was like, You know, and you know, really, when you come from that family, that kind of family, it's nothing really you can defend, because that was pretty normal. And I watched, you know, I watched some of my aunties. I remember watching her, this one black debtor guy come flying out the door, and she comes flying out, and she takes this full can of beer and throws it right at his head, and psh, you know, opens him right up. And so that kind of stuff in my life was, you know, that's possible. And so we took my sister, and we took her and buried her on a reservation in Rocky Boy, and it was very, very difficult for us. And but you know, walking through that experience, you know, I do remember lucky ladies, like they, like the blanket around me when I walked through that death, and helping me to make sense of it the best that I could at that time. And you know, when I had you know, I'd always ask why me. You know, how did I make it? And she didn't. I mean, you know, it was just you know, just be thankful. You know, don't ask why, just be thankful. Well, I walked through that, and, you know, as a result, my life began to improve. You know, things started getting better. You know, I'm working through this thing, and I'm starting to show up. And, you know, and 2004, I ended up, you know, being certified as a court reporter in the state of Washington, and I started working. I got to work at actually Abigail's Ghost for the deaf and the hearing impaired, who were for AA meetings, and I got to what's called real time writing. And what I would do is I would, as a stenographer, I would write down what people were saying, and the deaf could read it, you know, read the message going across the laptop or else the screen. And I got to do that, and then it led me into working in a treatment center where I got to help a deaf fella, you know, when he had to go to court and take care of some things, and then when he was in treatment, I got to interpret what was happening in treatment. And so what that looks like, some people think, well, do you have American Sign Language skills? And no, I don't. But what I do is I'm kind of the in-between place between people who maybe weren't born deaf but became deaf, and they don't have the American Sign Language skills. And so what I would do is, when I was working in colleges for the deaf community, that I would write down what was being said, and then they can read what was being spoken right now. It's kind of like closed captioning, as you see on TV. And so my life, I was able to do that. And I, you know, I remember thinking, it was actually happened on April 28th when I went and I passed that test. I didn't know that I had, but I was sitting there. I had just came out of an ectopic pregnancy, and I'd been gone from school for 2.5 months. It was a pretty wicked experience that I almost lost my life. And I remember thinking, you know, well, maybe I should just go tell them that I can't take this test today. You know, God, it cost me like $160 to get the state exam, you know, funds. And, you know, I don't have that kind of money. Maybe I should just go tell them. And they ended up, you know, I just, this voice said, you know, Rana, go take the test. You know, if you think about it, 4 years ago today, you walked into the treatment center, and look where you are today. And that voice gave me the courage, you know, to go and take that test. And, you know, you have to wait a month to get the results. But I passed that test. And, you know, it kind of like, you know, being able to show up and complete something was just a magnificent feeling of, you know, of being able to, like, of accomplishment, you know. And so, you know, as I'm going on through my life, you know, things are going good. I ended up, we bought a home in Tacoma, and I went and I found a sponsor there in Tacoma, and, you know, she's guided me through the fourth step, you know, through the steps again. It's probably my third or fourth process by now of going through the steps, but this time she introduces me to that fourth column, that one that says, what part do you play? Or did you do? Or what was your mistake? Or, you know, whatever it was. And I remember this, the agitation that I felt. And I'm not typically one that expresses agitation to somebody that's showing me great love. And I was like, what are you talking about? I mean, I was abused. How can you tell me that I played a part? And she was the one that took me further to say that, you know, the relationships that I have now are suffering as a result of the things that I've held on to back here, the mistrust, you know. And to be able to move me through that, it was like a great moment of clarity for me. She is one. She took me to the big mountain, you know. And I had some things that I wasn't ready ever to share with anybody, you know. And she took me to the big mountain, and I was able to, you know, to work through those things, and, you know, of saying some of the things that had happened to me that I was never going to tell anybody. And as a result of that, she said, "Me too." It happened to her too, and it was this. Ah, what a great feeling. And as I was going on through my life, you know, working these steps, I, you know, I decided, well, I am going to be sticking around here for a while. Because I had come to shore. By this time I come to shore, I remember the time when I had. I remember the moment, like, it came clear to me. I was getting ready to go to Malaki Ladies meeting, and I remember thinking, there's nothing I'd rather be doing on a Friday night than going to my Lucky Ladies meeting. And I remember the thought was so clear that I knew that I had a psychic change, because that was not my thinking a year ago. You know, I'm like thinking, oh my God, how do I get out of this? But being able to go into that meeting, I knew that something had changed. But one of the things I realized that coming to shore for me was just realizing that, you know, I did the best that I could do with where I was, but that I needed to get, I needed more. Because there were some things that I was holding on to that I was not going to do. And being on the shore, I realized, you know, it's kind of like I was this place like, that's it. This is it. I mean, I think I was my sixth year. This is it. You know, I mean, I remember this woman, I was listening to a CD, and she says it's never too late to start over. And so I began my journey again with the 12 steps. And I said, well, there are some things that I need to make amends for that I wasn't going to make amends for. And I remember this, I remember being here at this conference, and I was sitting there, and it was like this whole, it was like, you know, it was this huge, and there was a guy at the podium here, and he was talking about how he was robbing homes, you know, back in his drinking days, and he was talking about robbing those homes, and he was going to go make amends for that. He made amends for that. And I remember I was listening to him, and I tell you, there was thousands of people in this room, but it was just like it was him and I. And he was telling me the story, and he said he went and he knocked on the door, and I'm just going to paraphrase because I know I don't have the story completely right, but this is how it hit me. He said he would go to the homes that he had robbed, and he would knock on the door, and he would say, you know, did you live here at such and such a time? And if they said yes, he would make amends. He would say, I was the one who robbed your home, and is there anything I can do to make it right? Right? And he took this risk time and time again, and then he said he was at his last home, the last home on his amends list, and he knocked on the door, and he said it about three or four times before somebody actually answered, like he had to go back to the home three or four times before somebody actually answered the door, and by the fourth time, I'm guessing, right, third or fourth time, there was an old man who answered. And he asked them the question, did you live here at such and such a time? The old man said yes. He made the amends, and the old man invited him into the home. And he introduced him to his wife, and so he made the amends to his wife. And the wife said, thank you so much for telling us, because all this time we thought it was our son. And I was sitting there, and I was like, you know, it's kind of like the caterpillar and butterfly. You know, the caterpillar looks up and sees the butterfly flitting around and saying, you will never catch me in one of those contraptions. You know, like, I was sitting there thinking, oh, no way, no way. Because I'm thinking, I had those amends to make. I was like, oh, my God, I am not going to make amends for Robin Holmes. But you know what? What happened is that nobody ever said I had to do anything. In that moment, that guy made a connection with me, and I came into consciousness about something, right? I knew it was there. I was not ready in the moment to go run out and tell my sponsor about this great thing I got going on. I'm going to have to go make amends. I was kind of like, I sat with it for quite a while, you know, realizing, you know, gosh, if I'm going to live here, if I really want to know what happy, joyous, and free is, then I think I'm going to have to do these things. And for me, it was kind of like allowing the courage to come, where the courage becomes greater than the fear. And when I sat down with my sponsor and we began to go through the steps again, and we got to that step, I was ready. And I was ready to run out there, and I was like, okay, I'm going to go fly to Montana, I'm going to take care of this, I'm going to fly to Canada, I'm going to take care of that. And she's like, wait a minute. She says, no, you have to realize that this is not something you just go and you're just checking off. She said, what you did is like you did an exchange there. You gave up your peace of mind for a dress or for a bracelet. You know, you gave up your freedom. When you left there, you left your freedom in that place. And you must understand that, you know, that when you go back and you make this amends, that you're going back to receive those things. And this is not about just going back and, you know, getting it done. This is about truly understanding that. And it was like the perfect time for me to be ready to do that. And so I let it, you know, she also said that God has taken care of hearts over there too. And I knew that I was going to be able to make amends to some, but I didn't. I knew there was people out there that I couldn't reach. But I went and when the time came, I went and I made amends for robbing this home. As a result of that, I was able to find another person. From that amends I was making, I was able to find another person to go make amends. That God was able to, I was able to get take care of it in that time. She was able to take me to that person and take care of that. So it was really an amazing experience. And, you know, there was no burning bush experience that happens as a result of making amends like that. Because I think that if we had some kind of a higher rush, we'd be running out making amends everywhere, you know. But it was kind of like just a stillness, a calm inside of me that, you know, that I'm able to lay my head to rest. That when I'm working with other women, that I'm actually able to deliver something to them that I've done, you know, that I understand the purpose of what I've done. And I walked through these steps and I took care of those amends I said I was never going to make. I did the work and I went and I did it as thoroughly as I possibly could in that time. And I tell you, 2003 came along and I get a phone call, and it was a King 5 News. And, you know, it was such a strange call. I remember, you know, I was really feeling good because my husband and I were going to go take care of some business, and the sun was shining, and it was a news reporter. And he said, I just want to ask you what your thoughts are about your sister, Patricia Yellerow, being murdered by Gary Ridgway. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I didn't know who Gary Ridgway was. I've heard of the Green River Killer, but I've also heard of Jason, Freddy, the Krueger, you know, that kind of thing. That's kind of like how I related it, because it didn't seem so real in my world. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, you have the wrong number, because my sister was murdered. My sister was... like she died from an overdose. And he said, no, we have some pretty reliable sources at the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office that say that your sister was murdered by Gary Ridgway. And I remember like hanging up the phone, and it was almost like I didn't hear. I remember I was going back downstairs as if I was gonna just go and take care of business as normal. And then the phone rings again, and it was my sister. One of my younger sisters, who actually works at the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, and when she had found out, they had come and, you know, swooped her up and let her know what had happened. And I heard her crying, but I couldn't hear her crying. And I said, "Did you get that phone call from that news reporter?" And she said, "Yeah." And I was like, "Well, you know, they don't know anything. I mean, how could they even say that? I mean, God, it's been 5 years. How could they ever know this?" And she said, "Rana, it's true." And I picked up the phone. I called my sponsor. And you know what she told me? The first thing she told me was, "Start looking for the miracles. Start looking for the miracles." And I just kind of let myself be folded into the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that point, I've actually had joined Al-Anon. And I had just let the people just embrace me and walk me through that. And when we had gotten into, you know, being a part of that, you know, the court, the hearings, and the pleas, and the arraignment, and all that kind of stuff, you know, I just remember there was people, they were yelling. They were yelling at the prosecuting attorneys, because, as probably a lot of you know, that many people were waiting for his death. They were waiting for him to be, you know, to be killed for the murders that he had done. And so they were really angry. And I remember sitting with my brothers and sisters, and they were yelling out my sister's name for some reason, and I could feel them, my brothers and sisters, stiffen up, and I don't know, for some reason I was behind them. And I just remember telling him, "It's not about us." And this woman had said, "You know, me and my daughter are never going to have peace until this SOB is dead." That voice again inside of me, that larger voice, had said, "Rana, what do you choose?" And I remember I whispered right back, I choose peace. And, you know, I have many people in society. People have come up to me and have said, you know, if I were you, I'd be wanting vengeance. If I were you, they'd tell me what I had the right to be. But I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you read that place in the 12 and 12 and step 10, where it says that, you know, if I'm angry at somebody, I'm usually a problem, and if they've offended me, I'm still the problem. I'm sure it was a typo. that you still held me accountable for my and responsible for my peace of mind. You know, that and I had done this work, and I knew what happy, joyous, and free is, right? I know what it is, and nobody, I'm not giving this up, you know? And I remember telling this guy who came up to me, he was one of my neighbors, and he was telling me, like, what he would do, and I remember saying, the sun was shining that day, too, and I remember saying, if I was doing that, then I wouldn't be able to enjoy this day, you know? And that's what you've given to me. I've been working through these steps, and I still do. You know, we were able to walk through that experience with, you know, especially for my mom. I knew that it was a pretty heavier place for her to carry that than it was for me. And, you know, they told us, you know, don't read the transcript. You're probably not ready to read the transcript. And, you know, I just wished that I didn't read the transcript, because when I did, I kind of had a breakdown. And because now this stuff is in my head, right? I read about how her death was. And that had been one of the biggest fears for me, was knowing that, like, losing a brother and sister in a real violent way, or, you know, to alcoholism or any way at all. But in that way, you know, to read that information, it was very hard. But in talking with my sponsor again, she's like, you are responsible for the energy you give that thought. You are powerless over it. And you are responsible. And I just love her. I do. I called her before I came here, and she said, now you listen here, girl. She said, this is not about you. You know, you just turn it over to God, and you know, everything will work out. And but I do. I love her. I remember one time I was talking, because I was working through my sixth step. I was working through jealousy. Oh, my God. If any of you have jealousy as a character defect, oh, my goodness. It was so painful. Well, you know, when I was drinking, it was seemed a lot easier to deal with, because I would just act out. You know, I would just hit. You know, it was just so much easier. And then coming in here, when he told me I couldn't hit, I didn't know what else to do with it. So I just kind of internalized it until I got to a point where I was ready to really heal it. And but just a particular time when I was working through that sixth step, six and seven, I mean, it felt like the world of the physical and the world of the spiritual clashing, and then I've had this, like, outer body experience, and the only thing I could do is be still. But this particular time, my husband had gotten a letter from a woman, and I remember going, oh, my God, like, you know, he's like, oh, I wonder how she's been doing, like that. And I was like, who? And he said her name, and I was like, oh, like, everything just kind of starts shutting down inside of me. I could feel it. I withdraw physically, mentally, and spiritually. I don't know what to do. You know, I go into my office, and I'm like, I call my sponsor, and I'm like, I'm telling her what's going on, and she's like, girl, I understand, right? And I was like, you know, something's been wrong with her, because she had, you know, and really, but at the time, I didn't know that she was sick, and nobody knew she was sick. That she had, she was acting really funny, and we didn't. And later on, we found out she had cancer. But I thought, you know, something's been really wrong with her, so maybe I better call somebody else, because she's agreeing with me, and this doesn't feel right. So she gave me the thing. She told me to write down what I needed to, you know, she had me write down my thoughts and whatnot. But I did. I felt like I needed to, you know, to get a second opinion. And so I called my other sponsor, because I do have two. And and she said the same thing. She goes, oh, I understand. I understand. And I remember thinking, well, it has to be because they're both women. And I remember, because, you know, I had never walked through this in a healthy way. I've never said it out loud. It was just a really very vulnerable place to me, because jealousy for me was a very low self-esteem, not enough, and so that wasn't something I really wanted to say out loud. And, you know, when I'm the type of person, I remember what my husband said back in 1986 when he said Whitney Houston was beautiful. I remember what he was wearing on that day, that kind of thing. I remember exactly where he was standing in his dorm in the Air Force base. And so I remember as I was working through that, it was very painful. I mean, I'm so glad I can laugh about it now, but at the time I'm sitting there, talking to my sponsor. She said she understood, and she says, "Well, what do you want to create?" And I was like, "Well, I don't want to make him wrong for my feelings. I don't know how to do this. I've never done it before." And so she said, "Well," she gave me words. These were her words. She said, "I'm feeling threatened," right? So I'm writing this down. "I'm feeling threatened by the fact that you received this letter. And I'm feeling very vulnerable." And I'm writing this down because even though I know that's what I feel, this is not something that I'm used to relating to this man, right? It's easier, can I just hit him? It's like... So I'm writing down these words because I have no words. Again, I've never walked through this in a healthy way. I'm writing, and she says, "And make sure," she says, "now he gets to do whatever he wants. I mean, he's going to do whatever he wants, and you don't get to do anything about that. You just need to say what you need to say." And so I went, and I was nervous, you know, and I'm trembling, and I tell him, you know, like, "I'm very vulnerable. I'm very threatened by the fact that you've got this letter, and I want to show up in a good way so that I don't make you wrong, and I'm feeling vulnerable because," right? And then all of a sudden, he just started ripping at me. I was like, "Oh, my God." And she's like, "But you don't get to say anything." So I'm sitting there just listening, right? And I knew that I had said what I needed to say, and even though I really wanted to hit him, I didn't. I walked downstairs, and I don't know, about 20 minutes later, he came down, and we began talking about it. And I tell you, something that might have traumatized me for, like, you know, if you had the type of person who holds on to resentments for years, that I could have held on to that for quite a long time and used it against him anytime I wanted to. But it was so different. Like, I was able to walk through it. And what happened for me in that moment, what I didn't know, was I created a choice for me. I created the ability of showing up the way that I normally do, withdrawing physically, spiritually, and mentally, hating him every time, you know, the thought would come up, you know, even in a good moment, I would use it against him because I remembered it, or coming into this place of, I can say what I need to say, and listen and be heard, and then let go. And, you know, it was quite a very freeing experience for me. But the thing about the sixth and seventh step is that jealousy, it didn't just go away. I had to practice what I wanted to create many, many times. And so when the Super Bowl came and Janet Jackson's boob fell out, you know, and I'm a, you know, we talk about, you know, we compare our insides with people's outsides. And that's what I was doing at the time. You know, I was like, "Oh, my God, he's at the Super Bowl." I couldn't go because I knew she was going to be there. And she said, "Well, you don't have to suffer through that. You know, go do your own thing." I'm on the phone with my sponsee, and I'm, you know, doing the thing. And she's like, "Yeah, did you hear about Janet Jackson's boob falling out?" And I was just like, I just kind of froze. I was like, "I got to go." Right? I called up Dixie, you know, help, you know, and she helped me through that again. I had to practice showing up in a different way many, many times. And one of the things that I know about recovery for me is that, you know, when I'm taking care of myself, especially with this particular character defect, I know the day that I met it. I met it, it was a very nice hot summer day, and I was with my brothers and sisters, and my stepmom let go of my hand and took one of my other brothers and sisters' hands. I don't know which one it was, but all I know is the feeling. I remember the feeling as if it was like, that's the day we met, and I had no way to express it. I just withdrew physically, spiritually, and mentally, and that's just how I did it, unless I got drunk, and then I had a whole different way to deal with it. And then, but, you know, to be able to know that when I am taking care of myself, my well-being, my spiritual state, that emotion, that feeling does not touch me. And, you know, as I walk through and I have a really good life today. I don't know where we are. As I walk through my life and the things that have happened to me, that, you know, it's been in these rooms of recovery that I have been given a voice. And I remember the first time when I came in and I performed my Native American flutes. It was on this stage. I was over there in that corner. And I was very, very nervous. I was sitting there shaking and playing my flute, and people thought I was embellishing, but it was me doing this. And my flute told on me, squawked away, and I stopped, and I began to play again. It was like my recital, because, you know, one beautiful thing about recovery is that the people, they just lifted me. And I played my flute that day, and as a result of that experience, playing for my friends, whether, you know, in their homes or in recovery, wherever, I just have gotten the opportunity to perform with R. Carlos Nakai, Mary Youngblood, if any of you are flute, if you love that Native American flute. And I use my music for healing. I play for hospice, and I've journeyed with people. They're going on the other side. I've got to play my flutes for them. And, you know, I put my court reporting business on the side because this is, like, where I thrive. And I don't know, it's just been incredible. You know, I remember my sponsor, Georgia, before she passed away in 2005. Actually, I lost my mom and Georgia. My mom died from a double aneurysm in 2005 and left us with a legacy of 25 years of recovery herself. And it's so, yeah, it is really great. And she just really loved working with the Native American community, just knowing, you know, what they were up against and losing both those two powerful people in my life. You know, I remember Georgia telling me, you know, she was here at a meeting. She says, I would have killed a stranger. And I didn't understand what that meant. Like, she would have killed a stranger. I mean, but what I know today is that, you know, I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I'm a friend, and I'm a grandma. I'm a grandma three times. And I tell you one thing, you know, they talk about, you know, if we would have planned this, we would have ourselves and got what we wanted, we would have shortchanged ourselves. And the ability to be able to come up here and show up and be a part of this conference, to be able to come and share recovery with my daughter, Donna, as I have with my own mom, that it is truly a blessing. And she has 4.5 years of sobriety. She's a mom. She's going to school. She's taking care of that little baby girl in a way that I had no clue on how to take care of babies. And she's being guided by the women in recovery to be a good mom. And I'm so grateful for that. And, you know, it's just one of those things of being able to realize when your children come in that I'm ready for them, that I'm ready for them. Just like when my children have come in, you've been ready for them. And the beautiful thing is I remember telling them, saying, you know, your kids are going to come back. They are going to come back. You just need to make sure you're ready. And I pass that down to my other brothers and sisters. Unfortunately, I have 9 brothers and sisters, and one was fostered out. I have an older sister, Ronica, who some of you met, who's from New York. And I have family in New York also. That's where my African-American culture comes from. And that's where she was born and raised, and I was a city girl. And she has 3 years, like so 19 years of recovery. And the rest of my brothers and sisters are still out there suffering from this disease. And that's why it's important for me to do Al-Anon too, because I've really needed the strength of being able to let them live and to be able to live and be able to participate in my family's life. And that's what Al-Anon has given to me also. But in Signalist of Purpose, I want to say thank you so much for having me here. I wanted to say enjoy the rest of the weekend and know that, you know, I was sitting there thinking that this has been for me in the sense of that God has said that he wants me to be here, and I'm so grateful that you are all here, so I'm going to go ahead and close with that. Yeah.